she or her. It's good to be here, comrades. It's a really, so I'd like to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the lands in which I'm speaking from, which is the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, paying respects to their elders past, present and emerging, and acknowledge that this land was stolen and sovereignty was never ceded. So this talk is really going to be an expansion on and build on the articles that I've been writing for Green Left and for my blog over the last couple of weeks, and really trying to talk about the intertwining crises that we're meeting, which is both the health crisis that's been caused by the pandemic, and then the associated economic crisis, which has been triggered by the pandemic, but is really just exacerbating the crisis tendencies of capitalism that have been at play for some time. And like, people have been waiting for the next financial crisis to hit, and it's just the perfect storm in some ways. And we can maybe talk about that in discussions. And I think we need to start by saying that this pandemic would have been difficult to contain for any economic system, but because the health crisis of this and this type of health crisis would have triggered some level of economic disruption, but that things have been made much worse by both the capitalist system's drive to constantly expand profits at the expense of the well-being of humans and the planet, and by the policy dictates of neoliberalism, which have sought to drive down social spending on public health, and at the same time increase the extent to which healthcare is commodified. And that's highlighted by the US, which has got the highest per capita spending on healthcare, but also, quite frankly, has a terrible, terrible healthcare system, which fails to meet the basic needs of the vast bulk of society, and where getting sick can be a financial disaster from which people can never escape. However, the US is not alone. As Emma Clancy points out in her excellent recent article on the European Commission health policy, which is available on her blog, Emma Clancy, the European Commission has been attempting to drive down the level and quality of public healthcare in the European Union for the past few decades, which has been a significant contributor to the ability of the individual healthcare systems of the European Union nations to respond to the crisis, most notably in Italy and the Spanish state, which we're going to hear about later on from Dick and possibly someone from Italy. I want to talk about my thinking in this period on how we respond to in the interests of working people, and how we use this opportunity to not just make people's lives better within the context of the crisis, but how do we move forward to challenge the system that is in crisis and build a better world. So some of the things I'm not going to talk about health policy. I'm not a medical expert, and beyond some general ideas around the need to limit the spread of the infection to save lives and improve the capacity of our health system to save lives, I don't know enough about epidemiology or virology to comment on that stuff. And I'm also not going to talk about the legal measures that the state's taking. I think that we're in a very difficult situation, and I don't know enough about the law other than to say that the state will take some chance, take the opportunity to try and expand their power in ways in which we are unhelpful, but at the same time, and we need to oppose, but at the same time, there will probably be some steps that are necessary at the same time. So I think that we can't prejudge any proposal. I mean, and we need to face everything on their merits, and we need to follow, to paraphrase Trotsky, that we can't just say that because the capitalists are doing something, it must be bad. We have to look at what they're doing and why they're doing it, and then make a judgment about what we think is the appropriate course of action in the given moment. So what do I want to talk about? What I wanted to do is draw on my experience around industrial questions and around economic responses, largely informed both by my experience as a unionist and as an industrial and economic sociologist. If you've been reading my articles in Green Left and on my blog, you'll have seen an evolution in the issues that I've been raising and how the demands I've suggested had modified as the crisis has unfolded. And I'm not seeking to develop a unified systematic response, this will sound arrogant. It's not supposed to be arrogant. But drawing on what Gramsci said about his writing during the Red years in Italy in 1919 and 1920, just dealing with the immediate challenges of the day. So what do I see these as being? Well, in the beginning, I think that the challenge we were needing to address was around people needing to self-isolate and if they were potentially ill and if they were infected. The problem that emerged from that is that while people should have been self-isolating, that our system was not and is not set up to support the majority of people from being able to actually do that. In Australia, there's 3.3 million people who are employed casually. They have no leave. And so them self-isolating would mean them just not being paid for weeks at a time. And that's something that is unfair to be asked of. The initial responses was from the ACT and unions was to call for special leave to cover that, particularly for a two-week period. I'll talk a bit about what I think about some of these demands. Subsequently, the government the Morrison government has put forward a range of stimulus packages focused on giving cash to small and medium employers, although that's involved in the last couple of days, which I thought I was going to have to completely rewrite this talk. Because I thought they were going to have an amazing, I was really hopeful they were going to have an amazing, amazing package, but it's pretty shit. And I'll go into some detail about what's wrong with the package that they've put forward. We've seen some expansion of welfare payments, and this is an important step, but again, I'll go into some of the problems about what's wrong with that in terms of the fact that it's not extended enough. It's been backdated too far, in terms of when it will kick in. And it's not permanent, which is what we need to do. We need to have the increases that they're talking about in terms of the job seeker allowance and for students, really a reflection of the inadequacy of Australia's welfare system. And we've subsequently had calls for wage subsidies via the tax system, both by unions and employer groups, which, the government made announcements about, yes, over the last couple of days. And there's been a range of other announcements and calls, which I'll touch on at the end in terms of what I think is good and bad about those proposals. My concern from the get-go has been that the real danger was not the imminent health threat, as terrifying as that is, and it's super terrifying, particularly when you look at what's happening in Italy and Spain at the moment, but also other parts of Europe, and what's going to happen in the US, because the US is going to be a nightmare. But the consequence of the significant shutdown of the economy on working people, and I'm using the term working people to talk about both people in direct employment relationships and people whose relationship to production may be more accurately described as petty bourgeois. The first challenge is that we need to urgently stop the spread of the virus, which means as much as possible closing down the bulk of the economy. Except for those parts of the economy we need functioning to keep people alive or to allow people to keep the essential workers to keep functioning. So healthcare, food production, power supply, manufacturing of personal protection equipment and other medical goods, medical research, distribution networks, childcare education for those still at work, which should only be the essential workers, public transport for people moving people around to work, and that is that everything else is pretty much not needed. If they can function at some level online, but that's fine. But if not, just close it down. That's my personal view. And that's been part of the struggle in Italy in the last week, where there's been a general strike by workers in a lot of manufacturing areas who have been required to attend work, but with very limited protection around maintaining their health. And there was essentially stay home in the last week by tens of thousands of Italian workers. The second challenge is, in my view, is ensuring that people are able to survive. This means special leave, initially to cover isolation, quarantine, recovery from illness. However, I think that the call for 2 weeks leave for all workers, which the ACT put forward, was good. It was also insufficient and should have been and this call should have been around, at that point, around unlimited leave to meet people's commitments, particularly as the economy slows down. And whilst I think that initially this needs to be done through companies' cash reserves, even the largest companies will run out of money if they are not trading. And so the demand for wage subsidies, which the ACTU started raising in the last week or so, and was supported unevenly by business, is really important. It's really important to guard against job losses and to try and maintain people's purchasing power as much as possible, as well as the increases in welfare payments, which I've already mentioned, which need to also be made permanent. However, companies, particularly large companies at risk of failing, should simply be nationalised. So And we should be looking at this as an opportunity to try and position the economy around the need for just energy transition post the current slowdown and the pandemic. So over the past 2 days, the government has announced a wage subsidy scheme, and that was just days after they rejected the call. The initial reports, particularly in the Financial Review, suggested that it was going to be similar to the schemes in Britain and Denmark, where they guaranteed a percentage of workers' wages. So the British scheme, I think, was 80% of workers' wages, and the Danish scheme was 75%. However, the Morrison government scheme does not do that. Instead, it sets some quite high qualifying barriers for businesses. So it means that for companies that have a revenue of less than $1 billion a year, they have to have lost 30% of their revenue. And for businesses that have a revenue of above $1 billion a year, they have to have lost 50% of their revenue. There's a lot of those businesses. There's a lot of businesses that just won't qualify, but they're going to struggle. Or they won't qualify for a while and they'll struggle. The payments will only start on May 1. They'll be back out of the March 1, but I'm not sure what people are supposed to do for 2 months if they've been stood down without pay. And the payments will be at 70% of the median wage, which is about $1,500 for all workers. And that's irrespective of their normal hours, what their normal wages are. And the money will go directly to companies. It's unclear how the payment will work. The Centre for Future Work suggests that workers will receive a maximum their normal wages, which means that some companies will be in a position to pocket the additional payment. It also needs to be acknowledged that for casual staff to qualify, they have to have been working for more than 12 months for the employer, and it's unclear how that's defined. It's unclear how breaks of service will work. For those that don't know what a break of service means, it means there's been a gap in the employment, which is very common for casual workers. And so without that being clear, it's very hard to know exactly how some of this stuff will work, and we're all, everyone who's looking at it is trying to work, try and get their heads around it. And that's been the problem with a lot of the government announcements, is that they're very light on detail. And there's a lot of grey to be filled in. And as you fill in the grey, you find out that what looked like a pretty shit deal is even shitter. So I need to say that while the announcement is a positive and significant step, like the early announcements by the government, it's being delayed too much and it's insufficient. Payment needs to be brought forward, and equally important, it should be capture a greater share of workers' actual wages. And this fight will need to occur both at the level of lobbying government but also in ensuring that all the subsidy money that is given to businesses flows through to working people and is not used to bolster the company's cash reserves. And whilst it may seem unrealistic to demand more, the rate at which the government is announcing new stimulus packages, generally after the previous packages proved itself inadequate in just days, shows both the pressure the government and the ruling class are under and the extent to which they don't have answers to the problem facing the planet. It suggests we could rapidly enter a serious period of legitimation crisis. I'm not going to explain what that means. We can talk about it in discussion. It essentially means that the loss of people's confidence in the ruling class to rule, and their own loss of confidence in their ability to rule, which means that it's vital that we have a vision of what could be done to meet the challenges facing working people and to be raising those demands and be trying to spread those demands. So having said that, I just want to talk about two things that have emerged in the last few weeks. The first is the idea from the government around the idea that workers should draw down their super as a way in which to meet gaps in their income. And we have to say that proposal is a recognition by the government that their response is entirely inadequate. And it's aimed at shifting across the cost of the crisis directly onto working people, forcing them to mortgage their futures to survive in the here and now. And that many of the most insecure workers won't have the money to draw down on. So for those that don't know, the proposal is that you'd be able to draw down $10,000 this financial year and $10,000 next financial year. Lots of workers under 30 don't have that much money in their super accounts. And even in the late 40s, the average super account is about $60,000. So we're talking about a very large proportion of people's retirement savings that they would just be, they would never be able to recoup. So there's a real danger of that proposal destroying all or substantial parts of the retirement savings of working people, and creating a space for speculators to profit even more as funds are forced to sell off assets in order to pay demands from members for cash. Needs to be remembered that industry superannuation funds are major investors in many public-private partnerships, which is a problem of itself. Public-private partnerships are a really terrible way for governments to pay for infrastructure, like super bad ways. But it that process will mean that companies that the super funds will be forced to sell off assets, and it may work as a mechanism to further and intensify the much more effective privatisation of those projects. And when I was discussing this talk with a comrade, they said, I think that the thing that many on the left miss about superannuation is that it is property in trust. And so basically it's inviolable from a capitalist perspective. It's not a pension that can be rated by government or company. But the drawdown and subsequent potential for the liquidity crisis would change that situation significantly, because they would be able to raid those assets which are held in trust for working people's future. So we need to reject the idea of drawdowns and super, but it's not a question about what individuals should do. Like, if a person's desperate to survive, they are going to draw on their super, and there's nothing wrong with that. Because if you're struggling to survive and you can draw on your super, what else are you going to do? So we have to centre the demand for income maintenance, as well as the permanent increase in the age pension to a level of a livable wage coming out of this crisis. The final thing I want to touch on, which has sort of shifted a little bit in the last few days, which I have talked about on my blog, and there probably may be an article coming out in Green Left in coming issues, is around the call for rent strikes. There has been a growing call for people to not pay their rent. For many people, as they lose their jobs or are still down, there will be a real question regarding their ability to pay rent. And they're going to face a Sophie's choice of between paying rent or eating. And they may not even have that choice. They may not be able to do it either. And in this context, the call to not pay rent or suspend rent mortgage payments makes total sense. Obviously, the government's announced that they're doing a moratorium on evictions for 6 months, and they're and there's been agreements from the banks around mortgages. However, the problem is that if there's a generalised effort to not pay rent by people who can pay rent, we risk a deepening of the crisis. So my view is that if people can afford to pay their rent, they should, or they should pay a bit of it. From my point of view, the primary problem that we face at the moment is around protecting people's incomes, the incomes of working people. And so if we are able to do that, all the other things that people are raising become secondary issues. Like, if you've got your income flowing through and it's guaranteed, you can pay your rent. If you don't need to go to work and you're getting paid, you don't need to worry about childcare, because you don't need to go to work and you can stay home and you can look after your children. And then teachers don't need to be at school. And childcare workers don't need to be at childcare establishments, except for providing teaching and childcare for the workers in essential industries. I think that the events of the last month, the rapid shift in the position of college and government, along with the announcements of wage subsidies globally, shows the ruling class is unsure how to respond and are extremely susceptible to pressure. And we need to be taking this opportunity to raise demands and not only address the immediate challenges facing us, but which challenge the right of capital to dominate our society. This is an unprecedented challenge for society, but it is also an incredible opportunity to build social solidarity, community power, and fundamentally challenge the logic of not only neoliberalism, but capitalism itself. There will be a need to restart many industries post the pandemic, and that offers a serious opportunity for discussion as to what that reopening and retooling should look like. The crisis has highlighted a broad range of issues that around which there's a real need for to have a discussion around, such as the expansion of public health systems and for public housing. Both of these would be serious opportunities for both jobs and the transformation of our economy, from something that is a source of private wealth to a social good. Certainly, there's a real opportunity for the construction of renewable energy as a mechanism for rebuilding the manufacturing sector in public hands. In all of this, we should be arguing for the right of working people to have a say, both in our communities, but also in our places of work, and the vital role. And this has been highlighted by the vital role that working people are playing in keeping the world functioning at the moment. through this crisis and the total inadequacy of the market to respond effectively. Okay, I just got my 15-minute signal, so I've got one paragraph left to say. So to do this, we need to be creative, we need to be bold, and we need to build alliances based on the dynamics of the movement today, not historical divisions. Another world is possible, so let's build. Let's work together to build it. Be realistic, demand the impossible. Thanks a lot.